This is the Leading Saints podcast. With the new name of our organization, we are going big. How are we going big? With a huge leadership conference happening November 27th in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now don't worry, if you don't live in Utah, it will be broadcast completely online for the world to see. This event will transform your ward council as you hear from Steve Schallenberger, Scott Robley, and even one of our most popular guests in the history of the podcast, Deanna Murphy. This is going to be a transformational event as thousands of members of ward councils gather in Salt Lake City or gather around their computer and apply leadership principles that will move your leadership to the next level. See all the details and get your entire ward council registered for free at leadingsaints.org.
Hello, everyone. My name is Brant Malone, host of the Mormon News Report podcast. I am coming to you live from Detroit, Michigan. And I just have to say, I am so very proud of leading LDS and all the great work that Kirk Rankin has done. As a young men's president, there are so many times where I feel like I'm throwing anything against the wall to see what can stick, not only with activities, but just trying to relate to these kids. And it's so important to have a resource like Leading LDS, where leaders can come together, share best practices, and develop better ways to connect with youth today. I'm so proud to consider Kirk Rankin a close friend of mine, and I know when there's something big going on in the world of Mormon news, especially going on with leadership, that Kirk is the right person to follow. So please continue to listen to and support Leading LDS Podcast.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kirk Frankham, and I will be your host. This is another segment of How I Lead, where we strive to find the most prolific leaders out there who are serving in their own methods and finding success, or maybe they're not finding success, and we'll talk about that too. But in this segment, we talk with Dr. Jason Mount, who is an ER doctor down in Carrollton, Georgia, which I understand to be right outside of Atlanta. He's also a bishop, and as I understand it, he's also a very tall bishop at 7 feet tall. And a big shout out to Bobby Barron, who recommended that we reach out to Jason Mount and interview him, and we are glad we did. Now, we're trying a new approach to the How I Lead segment. I'm trying to keep these a little bit shorter, jump in right to the meat as much as I can. I'm just trying to respond to various feedback that I've gotten over the years as far as How I Lead episodes go. And also, I'm getting so many requests of some people that sound fantastic that I definitely want to interview on the How I Lead segment. So these may be shorter interviews that I release more often, and then we'll have our larger main pillar interview on Sundays around a specific topic or that type of thing. But with these How I Lead interviews, they'll be shorter, focused on a specific calling. We'll hit on some leadership principles and all benefit from what we learned. So try and keep it in about 30 minutes. Let me know what you think of them. So here's my interview with Bishop Jason Mount. Today, we're headed down to Georgia to talk with Jason Mount. How are you, Jason?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if we've had any guests from Georgia up to this point. And I think it's safe to say we haven't. So you're representing Georgia for us.
That's ironic because I've only lived here for about 15 years and originally from California. So I'm sometimes shocked that I'm in Georgia myself.
Nice. And now you're a medical doctor down there. Is that right?
I am. Yes.
And what type of medicine do you practice?
I practice emergency medicine.
Wow. So you get the bleeders.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Is that the type of medicine you saw yourself going?
Yeah. When I first wanted to go to medical school, I always thought I'd be a psychiatrist. And then once I experienced medical school, I was attracted to other fields. And I began my residency training after medical school in orthopedic surgery and really loved it, but realized that I wouldn't have a lot of free time in my life if I pursued that career. So I changed and I chose emergency medicine, which is a really good fit.
Nice. And so is it, as we see on the television shows, I remember watching ER growing up and I'm sure there's days like that, right?
Oh, certainly. I always watched ER as well as it was on while I was a medical student, and we enjoyed that. But those shows, they'll show you the exciting cases where you have to move fast, and those happen, but it's not from the moment you show up to work till you go home. But there's a lot of routine things as well.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, I bet it's an exciting and fulfilling occupation for sure.
I love it. Yeah.
That's great. And so are you currently a bishop right now? Is that right?
I am, yes.
And so how long have you been serving as a bishop?
I'm coming up on the end of the third year.
Oh, nice. So we have an expert on the line here. This
Oh, please.
right.
You may want to go for someone else for that.
I bet. And so what do you remember about when you were first called as a bishop? What were some of the circumstances and that led to that? And when the phone rang and how did that happen?
Well, this is interesting. I was in the bishopric at the time, and I'd been in there for 2 or 3 years. And I'm sure many of the listeners who've experienced this understand and know, probably shake their head, yes, I know that feeling. About 2 months before the call came, I knew it was going to come. I was just, one time I recall being getting ready for church, actually, early morning meetings, we call it, before sacrament. And the Spirit just made it clear, you're going to be the next bishop. And that it was a little nerve-wracking. And interestingly, I told my wife that feeling, but I didn't share it with the bishop that was, you know, with whom I was working. But during the next 2 months, he and I often would find ourselves alone, and I'd ask him questions about how do you handle this situation as a bishop and how do you handle that one? And he would explain it to me, and then it would get quiet. We'd look at each other, and I know that he knew and he knew that I knew, but we never said it together that I was going to be the next. So that it was very interesting.
Do you remember the type of questions you were asking him in that moment?
Oh yeah. I was asking, you know, if a priest, for instance, confesses that he's done this, what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to say? How are you supposed to handle that? There was confidentiality questions as well that I had because I didn't understand how you'd handle that. Just questions coming to mind, like if I'm sitting in the office and someone talks to me about this, how am I supposed to handle it? That type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And was this bishop coming? Did you say he was just coming to his time of 5 or 6 years as being bishop? Or
actually, no, it was a little more interesting. Our stake president was coming up on his time to be released. And there was some general authorities coming to interview the bishops in the high council to see who would be the next stake president. And as that time neared, I also realized that the man who I was serving with would be either the new stake president or in the stake presidency.
Gotcha.
So I that came a little later, but that's what happened. So
do you remember sitting in state conference and seeing him stand up to be sustained and thought, well, I guess that's where the prompting came from?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And I know that feeling well. That's that the bishop I replaced. He stood up at a state conference and thought, wait a minute, that's my bishop. And then how long after that did the phone ring after state conference?
It was within a week because he had to serve as bishop and stake president, and he was motivated to get out from one of those.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. And pretty typical. I mean, as typical as being called as a bishop is. That extension of the calling came and you accepted and off you went.
Yes. Uh-huh. That's right.
Anything about the preparing to be the bishop, you know, choosing counselors or putting things in order that you remember from that experience?
It's really interesting, at least with how it works for me. Often when I'm considering people for a calling, sometimes it's readily apparent who should be that person and it feels right. And I run with it. Other times when it's not so apparent, I get, you know, I think about it and pray about it. And often I don't really receive an inspiration on who should be it. So I make my own choice. At other times, the Lord answers and lets me know this is what you should do. I don't know if that's how other bishops experience it, but I find at times, it's not that he doesn't care. It's just that whatever, he lets some decisions be up to us without his input.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That has been my experience too. Many times I thought, well, I'm going to go this direction and then I would be taking another direction. And other times I just sort of felt like, oh, I don't feel one direction or another. And man, I wish it wasn't up to me. I'd rather, you know, have a strong spiritual impression. But I think that's helpful for leaders to hear that sometimes it's just up to you.
Yeah, I think I've learned that in the 3 years. I'm a fairly slow learner and I'm not being humble with every calling I've had. I seem to just figure it out at the end of the calling, and then I'm put in somewhere else so I can be a novice again.
Yeah.
So yeah, I figured that out. It took several years, but sometimes he wants us to make the decision without his input.
Anything else as far as that experience of being called as bishop or that first year that would be worth mentioning that helped you develop as a leader?
It was just interesting to me that that he let me know that's what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of thing, because I don't need that for my own testimony. You know, I've already been converted and I know what's true and what isn't. So I don't need the Lord to let me know things that are going to happen in the future. But when he does, I'm always grateful. And of course, it strengthens my testimony. And it always impresses me that he has the time and the capacity to care about a single person with such a seemingly insignificant thing as a calling on a ward level. Because it's a very micro thing, not a macro thing. But he does, and he can, and that's what's impressive.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Maybe give us, what are the demographics or geographics of your ward that would be helpful, just to put your ward in a context as far as what you face in that leadership role?
Okay. Our ward is one of nine in a stake in Atlanta area. We're about an hour west of Atlanta. So we're considered really a rural ward. And our average sacrament attendance is probably about 150. And our ward boundaries are, they used to be larger. Some reorganization made them a bit smaller, but we're essentially a full county, upwards of 90 miles long. So we have some spread out members, but we seem to be well-staffed priesthood-wise. Recently in our ward building, the stake presidency created a young single adult branch, because we do have a university here, and that pulled from our ward and other wards all the young single adults. And so for a time, that was a bit of a challenge, because I used a lot of them in different callings in the ward, but it's worked out well. And we still see each other, seeing that they're in the same building as us. But it's basically a family ward, and the primary probably has about 50 active kids in it. So about a third of the ward in sacrament will be children, if that gives a picture of what our ward is like.
Perfect. And so it's said about 90 minutes from one end to the, or 90 miles from one end to the next, right? So and some people may have a bit of a drive to make it to church.
Correct.
Nice. And the closest temple, Atlanta?
Atlanta.
In Atlanta, right? Okay.
Yep, it's about 1 hour drive.
Oh, great. Awesome.
It's not bad.
Now, yeah, you'll take that. You know, it's not my walk down the street here in Utah. Where I have to pick which temple I'm going to go to today, right?
That's right. When you cross the street, you're in another stake.
Exactly. How about with, you know, in preparation for this interview, you put down some experiences and principles and that you've maybe applied to your leadership or seen come to the surface of your leadership. And you talk about this concept of being a servant leader and serving those you lead. And this is, and I'll be honest with you, a lot of times I've done a lot of these How I Lead interviews where I ask a person, you know, what's the one principle of leadership you'd suggest? And by far the most one mentioned the most is you just got to love the people, right? You just got to love them. And which I appreciate and I would absolutely agree. But I'm mainly looking for like, what does that look like? What does being a servant leader look like in your world, day to day, week to week?
Oh, that's interesting. Where that comes from for me, at least every once in a while, you know, most of the time when I attend church or attend state conference or whatever, I'm listening, but not everything that's said or being taught hits me in the center of my soul and changes me. Much of it is just reinforcing and keeping me out of the world, which I think is one of the main reasons why we go to church. But every once in a while, someone will say or teach something that strikes me and changes me. And one of those things was an experience, I believe it was a state conference, our state president years ago. It may have been even a general conference talk. I don't recall, but in either case, it struck me. And it was an experience where a stake president and his executive secretary were in the hallway of the stake center, and a member approached the stake president and said, I would really like to get my temple recommend interview. And the stake executive secretary interjected and said, well, you'll have to make an appointment because the schedule's really busy. And the stake president, as was described in this experience, said, actually, when would it work for you, speaking to the member? Because that's how we'll do it. And then he made an appointment with the person. And then it was explained in the experience that I was listening to that the stake president told the stake executive secretary that I'm their servant, not the other way around, that whatever works for them will work for me. And that struck me. This is before I was a bishop or any type of leadership role like that. And it brought to mind also the experience in the scriptures where the Savior overheard his apostles arguing over who would be the greatest apostle. I assume who would be the leader of them as the 12 apostles. And then the Lord had to explain to them that whoever's the leader, whoever's the greatest, is the servant of all, which is the opposite of how the world views leadership, actually, and how they treat leaders almost like kings and royalty and presidents and the way they're reverenced and such. And so those two things combined within me to hopefully have the attitude that whatever anyone needs around me, I will offer it to them or give it to them because I'm their servant, not the other way around. And that's really helped.
Yeah, I love that. I love that story as far as articulating what that looks like in real life, right? And so are there specific, I don't know if policy is the right word, but habits and maybe in the culture of your bishopric that you have encouraged in order to really be the servant to the people rather than the other way around?
Well, you know, in very simple things, like when someone needs to speak to me for whatever reason, to have a recommend an interview, talk about a problem in their life or seek welfare assistance, I don't really require them to speak to the executive secretary. I don't mind if they come right to me. And I try whenever they say, I really need to speak with you, instead of opening my calendar and saying, well, let's do it on this date. I say, when would you like to speak to me? Do you want to do it now? I try to be more accommodating than leaders are in the world, if you know what I mean. And
yeah,
in leadership roles that I have in the community, it's a little different people. And it's just because that's the culture of the world. They go through secretaries to make appointments. They kowtow a little to you because you're a leader. But in the church, I try to make it so that it's really you that is the focus, not me. In fact, I have a habit of calling the bishop's office, not my office. I don't say, let's go meet in my office. I say, let's go meet in the bishop's office. That's a little bit reflective of some insecurity I have as being the bishop. I still feel, even 3 years in, that calling me the bishop is just very kind of, it's very awkward and it's humbling. And so I think I reflect that by saying, let's go to the bishop's office and talk about it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we often kind of think of that bishop's office as, of course, you know, the bishop needs an office. He's meeting with people. And in reality, in my experience, like once you have opportunity to sit on that side of the desk and experience, as I term it, watching the atonement from the sidelines, it really begins to feel like almost an ordinance room, right? That there's something extra sacred that happens in there as individuals bring their problems of their world and lay them on that bishop's desk, metaphorically speaking, you know? And so I love that, how there's sort of a reverence there that as how you refer to that office.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's intimidating to me even now, and I think it will be. And I think that's a good thing, so that I don't belittle it or treat it lightly. But before I go to church on Sunday in my personal prayer, I say, I'm about to go. And I think it reflects my nervousness, actually, because I don't want to give wrong advice and I don't want to give, you know, improper direction. So I ask the Lord, please let me know what you want me to say, because Jason Mount is going to mess it up, but you can get it right. So you please let me know what I can do to help them. What would you say? And I will say it.
Yeah, I think that's such humble advice to approach that, because especially when you get a few years into it, you know, 3-4 years, you've pretty much seen all the problems, you know, before at one point. And so you have a general approach, or I'm going to read these three scriptures and then I'll do this. And then here's the steps we're going to take. And so to just step back before each one and think, okay, like I'm hitting the reset button. Of course, those scriptures I can go to, you know, past experiences I can draw upon, but I'm just going to approach this with new eyes and see if we can connect on a more personal level and help this individual.
Right. It's really, there's so many, like you said very well, each case, although they may struggle with a common problem, they're coming at it from a totally different context. You don't know their weaknesses. You don't know their strengths. You don't know what caused them. You don't know the challenges that they have and all the intricacies, but the Lord knows. Hmm. And generally speaking, general advice is good advice, but not always. It's not always the way, the general advice isn't always the best advice, because it's a case-by-case basis. And I'll give you an example, and I don't know if this is reflective of bad advice, but I felt good about it at the time. And actually, after the fact, months later, it really was the right advice, but it wasn't something that you would expect a bishop to say. And it is in regards to a person who had a teenage child who was dabbling in Word of Wisdom problems, and they were asking questions about vaping and cigarettes and all that sort of thing. And my advice basically to them, which was kind of the not advice you generally encourage bishops to give to youth, was that they could, that, you know, I suggested to them that they permit the young man to vape with those vaping devices if it only contained water and not addictive substances, kind of in my mind as a step away from the addictive substances he was getting entrapped in. And with hindsight now, that advice was good and it worked. Now, I wouldn't generally go into sacrament meeting and say, you teens can vape as long as there's no nicotine in it. I would never,
all right.
That is, you know, I'd get released pretty quick. That's not the advice to give, but in a private personal moment as a stepwise fashion to get him away from addictive substances, but still going through the motions with a vaporizing device was the right step, because later he stepped away from the vaporizing device and he was done.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I'm curious to know, I mean, I love this principle, you know, as far as seeing yourself as a servant and, you know, rather than, well, we'll have to look at my schedule, turn that around and say, well, what's your schedule like? You know, using the, as far as appointments go. But, you know, we've talked a lot on Leading LDS about boundaries and the importance of boundaries, and that boundaries can oftentimes help you be a better leader. And so how do you not get carried away with just saying yes to everything? And you're, you know, you're just one man. And so if you respond to every request, it can, your head will be spinning here quickly. So is there any way that you do draw boundaries or sort of make that, that clear that, I mean, there are certain things that you can't do right at the moment?
Right. It is a really good point, because you can become overwhelmed if you have a wide open door type of policy and attitude. I do establish just personal rules as we go. And I generally don't have my personal cell phone out on the ward program. It's my home phone. You know, that's a boundary that I've set. And I check it to make sure I'm not missing anything. And a lot of people I've known for years, and they have my cell phone anyway. But for the general ward population, it's my home phone they're going to be calling. And so that helps establish some boundaries. Also, for things, for instance, if people need food order, they've learned that they really need to speak to the Relief Society president to get that going. And so we do some line of authority set up like that, because although I need to be involved in the decision making, I don't need to be the primary source.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there any advice that you tell your counselors as far as really emphasizing this principle of both, you know, being the servant, but also drawing some boundaries there?
Yeah, I do try to delegate. I mean, I have to. I think we appropriately delegate interviews and the annual youth interviews, et cetera, that have to occur to them, and encourage them, as is appropriate, to interview the youth on a timely fashion. We go through that each meeting and make sure that we're doing that. And we watch, for instance, Tempo recommends in our ward and when they're about to expire with members, and we'll actively seek them out. We'll split that list up evenly and approach it that way. And then I tell them, if anyone approaches them and really needs to speak to me, they can inquire about what it's regarding. And if it seems to be something they truly need to speak to me about, then let's do it. But if they just want a Tempo recommend interview, then they can take care of it without talking to me if it's appropriate. So there's a little bit of training that goes on with that. You know, initially when I became a bishop, it was yes to everything. Come in, let's do it. And then, as you mentioned, you quickly learn that you're going to be overwhelmed and you're going to do this for 8 hours after every sacrament meeting. And there's really people that are, it's their calling to help you with this. And so I had to learn that. It took about 6 months to get that down. I'm never fine tuning as we go, but.
Yeah. And we all go through those 6 months of sudden burnout. And then you think, oh, okay, I have to delegate more.
Yeah, that's right. Wait, the elders who are present can go into their home and see why their sink is leaking. It doesn't have to be me.
Right. And you also talk about, you discuss here that as far as this concept of administration versus ministration and or ministering, where some individuals, you've witnessed some bishops that I guess you were an elders quorum president under a certain bishop that just had this hit the ward running like a well-oiled machine. And then you saw a contrast of that as a new bishop was called, who wasn't necessarily as organized administratively, but that he brought new things to the table. What did you learn from witnessing that leadership?
Yeah, that was, I know with hindsight that was the Lord teaching me that he can use different types of men to fulfill the same calling. And And it was a really great lesson because I served as Elder Scrum president. I was young, and the bishop at the time was an entrepreneur, a millionaire, had multiple businesses, and was very good at running an organization. The primary president approached him and said, I need a new teacher. Well, there'd be a new teacher called, set apart, sustained, everything before the next Sunday, you know. and
wow.
And that's just how, yeah, he's much better than I am. And he just was very good at it. And that's how he ran things. And of course, he was a righteous man that I'm sure gave loving advice to people as well. After he was released, though, the next man that came in was not an organized administrator. He was a simple laborer, in fact. And, you know, when the primary president wanted a new teacher, it would 3 or 4 months later and several reminders later, it might get done. So it was kind of a mess when it comes to organizationally, but he put his arms around people and loved them in a way just as talented as that businessman did in his business dealings. He was just a teddy bear of a wonderful person. You just felt the love of the Savior when you spoke to him. And I just kind of sat in ward councils and in bishopric meetings when I was invited and watched the difference between these two men. And they were both necessary at the time. I think the ward needed a bishop who could run it like a well-oiled machine and get it all set up for the next bishop, who probably helped members that needed a bishop like that.
Yeah. So how do you see that, or what prompts you in your own leadership as bishop that makes you reflect back on that? Are there certain experiences that help you draw upon that story?
It's funny because there are times when I realize this, the Relief Society president has asked me for a new instructor, for instance. You know what? A month has gone by. You're acting like bishop. Why? When? And you need to be a little more like Bishop X right now. So I quickly try to get that done. So I find myself looking at those two men as really good examples of how I should be, but a combination of both, you know. You can't teach loving and you can't teach talented business administration, but you can move towards each one and by changing yourself to emulate them in a way, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Anything else as far as you look back on your time as a leader, any other principle that would be worth mentioning that's sort of shaped you as a leader?
Yeah, I do remember another experience. After my mission was completed, I came home and attended a university ward and was served in one calling. And then my next calling was as ward mission leader at the time. And I remember this experience I had really affected me. I, as a ward mission leader and as a just married person, I felt I was doing a good job. And I showed up to the church to attend a bishop, like a ward council, I suppose it was. But the bishop was in his office with the stake mission president. At the time, there was a stake mission organization. And so I sat in the clerk's office waiting for my turn to be called in. And maybe I'm confessing something I don't want to confess, but I could overhear everything they said.
So oh, no.
I sat there listening, and it wasn't about personal people. It was just about stake mission, ward mission stuff. Well, the stake mission president at the time had known myself and my family for our whole lives because I grew up in that stake. And so I knew who he was and we all loved each other, et cetera. Well, he said something that really got me upset. He said to the bishop, well, Jason Mount's a well-meaning young man and he has a good heart, but he's really not doing a very good job as a ward mission leader.
Wow.
So it really stung and my mouth dropped and I went through the shocked sensation and then the very angry sensation. And I didn't know what I was going to do about this because it really bothered me. So I processed that. I went through the next meeting and no one would have known I was internally upset and hurt. And then over the course of the next week, I went through some, I think, a learning process, I believe, guided by the Spirit. And I was reminded of the Moroni Pahoran portion of the Book of Mormon, where Pahoran is assaulted by Moroni by letter, where he says, you're sitting on your throne doing nothing and enjoying security and peace and food while we're starving and dying in the field. If you don't send us some troops and supplies, I'm going to come in there and remove you and everyone else from their offices and basically kill you all because you're lazy jerks. That's what Moroni's letter was. And Pahoran reacted perfectly to that criticism. He complimented Moroni for his passion and for all that he was sacrificing for the country. And then he explained why it appeared that they were doing nothing. They were, in fact, fighting their own insurrection and trying to survive with their lives. I think it was the Kingsmen is what they were called. But in either case, he had to explain to Moroni what was really happening. And I don't think we hear Moroni's reply, but I'm sure it calmed him down. But that inclusion of an interaction between two powerful leaders, I think has many lessons. And I learned one then. I realized that, like Pahoran, I was being falsely accused of doing a terrible job. And so I felt like I needed to inform the stake mission president and family friend that, in fact, I was doing a really good job, and I appreciate him and the job he was doing. So I did it like Pahoran did. I actually wrote him a letter and said, you know, I wanted to let you know that I overheard something you said about me in the meeting with the bishop. And initially I was hurt, but then I realized that what I've done poorly is not let you know, as a stake mission president, the activities we've been doing as a ward mission. And at the time, we had 7 investigators in our ward, 6 of whom were being taught in my home, and 6 of the 7 they had baptismal dates. So we were heavily involved in these people's conversions, and in fact had probably more baptisms than anywhere else in the stake, but he didn't know that. So I kind of took the blame to myself, told him I thought he was a great leader and I always looked up to him. He was my father's age, so I showed that kind of respect as well. And I apologized for not informing him of the activities of our ward, and I would do a better job. And I think it was worded in such a way that he didn't even need to apologize, and he didn't. He says, oh, that's so wonderful to hear. I'm so glad that you're serving as ward mission leader. And from then on out, I did a better job reporting to him on the activities of our ward mission.
Yeah, sure.
That affected me as a leader. For one, when I feel that someone's not doing their job, before jumping to the conclusion that they're not doing their job, I ask them, how's it going? What are you doing? And inevitably, they are doing their job, I just don't know it, or they're having a deep personal problem and it comes out at that moment. And that's always helpful because they can deal with it.
Yeah. That's one for the ages to remember there. Always remember that the time you overheard makes you wonder what people say about you as a bishop, you know?
I know. I don't want to know.
No, I'm sure it's all positive. Obviously, you were recommended to be interviewed here on Leading LDS, so I'm sure it's all good.
I hope.
Well, Jason, as we wrap up, you know, the last question I typically ask individuals who are on the How I Lead segment is, as you look back at your time, you know, primarily serving as bishop, but in other callings, leadership callings as well, how has being a leader made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. What I really enjoy the most about leadership callings is there are times, and they're, I think, relatively rare, when someone's speaking to me as their leader that I get to see for a moment how the Savior looks at them. And at those times, I'm extremely humbled. And I'm actually quite heartened as well, because I realize that He loves them very much, and He's very merciful and very quick to forgive. And I can sense that and feel that. And it actually gives my own personal self hope that He looks at me like that as well. So I think that, to me, would be the greatest thing that I've learned as a leader, is the insight into how the Lord looks at each of us. Imperfect children who He loves very much and is very quick to forgive, especially when we're humble and trying.
That concludes my interview with Dr. Jason Mount, or as his ward members call him, Bishop Jason Mount. Fantastic interview. What a wonderful, humble soul. I felt the spirit of his leadership and of the good he's doing down in Carrollton, Georgia. And I wish him the best. And a big shout out to Bobby Barron for recommending we talk with Bishop Mount. If you know of somebody who I should absolutely reach out to and get on the Leading LDS podcast, primarily in the How I Lead segment, please go to leadinglds.org/contact. And there you can fill out a form. Give us some information, some background, why you think that individual should be considered for the How I Lead segment, and we will share their leadership. And don't forget to go to leadingsaints.org to register for the November 27th Leadership Conference.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.